strong inside. When you're down and out, the streets get rough. You need love, but you just don't get enough. And you feel like no one's on your side. When you wanna throw it all away, and you've had it, don't surrender.
Hello and welcome to the third edition of DIY Portland. I'm Julie and this is a new show on the Thursday Radio Zine. So if you like it, let us know. You can call the station at 503-231-8032. Each show highlights a different kind of revolutionary do-it-yourself project going on around town. The last time I featured DIY businesses, I had a guest, Tim Calvert, on the show. And before that, the first show was about crafts and reusing materials. And this show will focus on women and self-defense. Earlier this week, I spoke with Carlette Jackley, who teaches self-defense to women and people in the LGBT community who feel vulnerable to attack.
Well, I've been involved in self-defense for the majority of my life. I got involved when I was 8 years old and just kind of worked my way up from there.
And what methods of self-defense did you start out learning?
Well, when I was 8, my uncle came back from Korea, and he was teaching me Taekwondo. And then when I hit about 19, I got involved with classical Kung Fu and did that for a few years. And then I got involved in some boxing and some French street fighting called Savate. And then a little later, I got involved in Arnis, which is a Filipino stick fighting. And then from that point, I just cross-trained in several other arts. They started blending. After you put in 40 years in a martial arts, somehow they just kind of compile in there, and things that are similar kind of conglomerate in your subconscious. And then when you need something, it just creates its own thing. It became its own animal within me.
How would you describe the art that you teach people now?
My art is a blend of all these different arts, but what I really teach is defensive response protocol. Martial arts is merely one aspect of defensive response.
And what kinds of psychological things do you teach people in terms of defending themselves?
You have to know what you're up against. So I teach... To know the enemy is to be able to overcome the enemy. Know their weaknesses, because that's why they call them professional. They sit around all day long wondering, how do I take this person? How do I get what they have? They're fixated on, that's their job. Whereas, how often do you really think about defending yourself against a perpetrator? You're busy living your life. To know how particular people function, how a carjacker thinks. Did you know that, like for carjacking, did you know the majority of them will take place on a two-lane road at an intersection? Not as many at a four-lane road where you got two lanes going each direction. They will look for areas. They will sit there all day long and watch traffic, and then they pick their target. Some of them are opportunists and just jump out and grab the nice car that they see coming by. But a lot of them will watch. And then if you take that particular route to and from work, they'll know that every day at 3:05, you're driving by in that nice Mercedes. And then they'll know on a Thursday when the guy at the convenience store shoves his dumpster out next to the street to get picked up, at 3:05, he can stand behind it. When you pull up to the intersection, he'll jump out and run over and tap his pistol in the passenger side window or the driver's side window of your car and order you out of the car. So knowing how these things happen, what would you do if that happened? If you're sitting there, you have to be aware of your surroundings at all times. Glance in your rearview mirror, kind of keep your eyes open, look back and forth. And if you see someone approaching the car, You can kind of read it. Does it look like he has a weapon? Is he pinned on you with his eyes and coming very rapidly? Then you're up to no good. First thing you do is take an immediate right-hand turn as fast as you can. You don't try to run the red light. You can get someone else killed or yourself. But when you see someone approaching the car, you can always make a quick right-hand turn. It's things like this that you have to be aware of, and if you know how they function, if you know what can happen, then you can be prepared. Defensive response protocol is all governed on having pre-planned response to given situations that you might be fearful of. When you have a plan, then you can respond. If you don't, most people will freeze when something occurs. They literally just freeze, they go blank because they fear. Have a plan. A plan gives you freedom. This is what gives you empowerment. You can live your life without as much worry. You'll know how to survey a situation or an area of your life that you need to be cautious.
When you teach women specifically, women are usually much smaller than their attackers and maybe not as strong. So how do you deal with that?
With what I teach, which is based in, its prime directive is evasion. The things that I key in on are the same weaknesses that all people have. I don't punch to the body. It doesn't do any good. What I do is I work nerves, joints, and primary targeting, which is the eyes, throat, and groin when it comes to an attacker. A finger in the eye, your eye is no different than mine, or my eye is no different than some great big ugly man, you know, somebody that's bent on doing me harm. It doesn't work off of strength. You work off of timing and creating windows of opportunity. When someone abducts you, they're full on. They grab you with all their strength to subdue you. You don't fight right away. You create a problem for that person. When someone grabs you, you turn into a rag doll. If you get all rigid, they can control you and make you walk. But if you turn into a rag doll, they have to pick up dead weight, which is extremely hard. You've doubled his workload. Then when he's dragging you along, he knows, he thinks he has the situation under control, where then he releases a little bit where he's not so full on with his strength and control. That's a window of opportunity, and then you shake loose and you run. You can strike him in the eyes or in the throat or slap him to the groin. It causes him to pause, destroys his focus mentally of what he's doing, and you break free and run. I work off of what I call known human response. So any given situation, if you create something, you can cause someone to respond the way you want to create that window of opportunity for escape. There's a lot of different methods to do this.
And unfortunately, you yourself have had a lot of opportunities to use these methods, isn't that right?
Well, yes. I'm an effeminate human being. And because of that, people can tell right away that you're different. You're not the typical person out there. And unfortunately, I was born between two worlds, a little bit of both male and female. But mentally, I was all female. And because of that, having ambiguous genitalia at the time, they just say, oh, this person is male. And I was forced into that category most of my life. But I behaved like a female, so the majority of people that met me figured I was gay. And growing up in the 50s and 60s, it was pretty tough if you were different. They had corporal punishment when I was in school because I graduated like 1971. Unfortunately, in 1972 is when they ruled, Supreme Court ruled that corporal punishment was unconstitutional. But every man teacher in grade school thought it was their job to beat the sissy out of me. So I was locked in storerooms. I was hauled down to the gymnasium and beaten with a cricket bat. At every opportunity, I was humiliated publicly, stood up in front of classes and screamed at, which naturally made me cry. But they were trying to make a man out of me. And I just turned to martial arts, boxing, and things of that nature to protect myself against these people. That isn't the issue. Everybody has stories like this that is like me. People that are born different, whether you're gay or whether you're transsexual or intersexed or anything else. But these are the things that actually I was able to take them and turn the bad into something good by creating something that would help protect people like me or others that need help that can't protect themselves. That's always been my motivation. I've spent a lifetime accumulating knowledge, spending thousands upon thousands of dollars at these different dojos, learning whatever I could to defend myself, and then at the same time turn around and pass this on to people that are seeking that knowledge.
And who are most of the people that you teach?
The majority are women, because when I decided to come out of the closet and have surgery and identify as openly as a woman, because of martial arts per se, within that field, it is a very macho-driven, ego-driven area of people. And when I did that, I knew it was going to completely let me out of the circle that I'd been in for so many years. I passed myself as a man the majority of my life. Even though I was completely female, when I was at home, I was Carlette. Always wore a dress, put on makeup, and just lived as a woman. But the minute I walked out into the world, I had to create that alter ego of protection. So I'd pull my hair back and put on men's clothes and walk out as Carl. I got away from the whole ego-driven crowd of men and professionals that I taught before, because they openly don't accept people like me. And that's fine and well with me, because I never identified as a male. So I turned to the gay, lesbian, bi, and transsexual community in Portland. I haven't run any ads or anything except on Craigslist. But that's where I'm mainly directed, is towards this and women as a whole. I don't exclude anyone, but the only people that openly accept me are either gay or transsexual anyways. So that's fine. I'd just as soon teach people like that, or open-minded younger people that know that there is diversity in the world, and it's okay. So that's who primarily I aim this for, because those are the people who suffer the most. I mean, a guy is basically a rock'em sock'em, walking around figure that starts wars and does crime. I mean, 99% of all violent crime in the United States is committed by men. The women are the ones that need protecting. Children are the ones that need protecting.
And do you teach children?
Personally, I try not to, but I will teach the mothers who can teach their children. Because what I teach is very simplistic in nature. It's not very complicated, but yet it's very effective. If, like for a child, how to get away from an abductor, what can you do, what are your options? I teach people to change their thinking, not to respond out of fear, but to try to keep a cool head and respond with looking for opportunity that might appear, or can they create an opportunity? What's at hand? That's what you start focusing on, not the perpetrator.
People come to your home for one-on-one sessions, is that right?
I teach out of my home. I teach out of a public park. I've taught out of play sheds at grade schools. I'll come to your home. You can come to mine. I'm pretty much open to anything. I tailor everything for an individual or a group.
Want to talk about some specific moves or ways of thinking that people might be able to take away today?
Yeah, one thing that's always concerned me is a lot of women, the first thing you want to do is, when their child gets beat up, is try to give them karate lessons. I wouldn't recommend karate, because all it does is teach your child to kick and punch, not to resolve the problem. The best thing that you can do for a child is to teach him to control others who are trying to hurt them, and the best art for that is jiu-jitsu. You control the attacker who's grabbing you or putting you in a headlock or trying to punch you. You control the attacker. And that is the best art for children at this time. It's more towards a sport there if you take away the striking in jiu-jitsu, which a lot of people, when they train children, don't teach them to strike. They teach them to control their situation.
Do you charge for your lessons that you teach right now?
Well, actually, it's more of a sliding scale thing, and it's on a need basis, depending on their dedication. If they really need something and they love what I'm teaching them, a lot of times after a while, I just drop charging and don't charge at all. It all depends on the need and the circumstance, and it's all judged on an individual basis.
And where do you draw that line between defense and offense? I mean, if somebody's coming to you and saying, I want to learn how to use a blade or a gun, or I want to learn how to, you know, attack in this way or that way, where do you draw that line for yourself about what is defense and what's not?
I don't want to be an enabler. I worry about karma. I don't want to enable people that are halfway unstable or have an ego problem so they can go start fights with at a cowboy bar or God forbid, go down and start beating up gay people. So I'm always aware of who this person is. I test them in many different ways when a new student shows up. First is patience and respect. I teach more classical Chinese in my manner. When someone comes to me and wants to learn something, I take them in as a friend and as a family member, and we sit. I break out the teapot, some green tea and honey, and we just sit and talk. And if they get to gnashing at the bit and wanting, I'm aggressive. I want you to teach me this. Oh, why do you need that? Why do you think you need that? I teach relaxation techniques. I teach meditation, how to calm the spirit and the mind so you become a more productive and whole person and better for the whole world that way. I have created a few monsters in my time which still bother me to this day. I've started out with an individual who I trained for 12 years, and they become almost like my son. And at the very end, when I sat them down and told them that I wasn't really the person they thought I was, they turned into a hateful bigot and turned on me. And this person is filled with so much anger, that's all they do is they look for places that they can use what I taught them. They bounce in clubs and they enjoy hurting people. He just turned to the dark side, unfortunately, and it's a thorn in my flesh now to know that I created this person who's gets enjoyment out of causing pain. I started governing who I teach probably about 16 years ago, and I've that way there's no regrets.
And how has that affected your practice?
I'm more at peace with myself, and it's a lot more happiness involved in it, and peace of mind. And
is there anything else that you want to say that I haven't asked you about?
Not that I can think of offhand.
Well, thanks for talking with me.
Sure.
Thank you, Joan Jett. That was a song called Don't Surrender. And that was an interview with Carlette Jackley, who teaches self-defense. In the last few minutes of the show, we'll have a few words from Leslie Peterson of the Portland Bad Dateline. I'd like to thank the women of Circle A Radio for this interview.
My name is Leslie Peterson, and I'm a volunteer for the Portland Bad Dateline. The Portland Bad Dateline is a small grassroots organization. It is currently being housed by the Multnomah County Health Department HIV Prevention. department, and also TURC, which is the Trans Identity Arts Resource Center, which is housed by Outside In. So it's like this tiny little organization that sort of is being supported by other bigger organizations. And what it is this. It's a sheet, and it's got descriptions of perpetrators of violence, perpetrators who victimize people who are prostituting on the street. And so what happens and how it works is that it's circulated amongst various social agencies around town, about 40 of them. And we can get descriptions directly either from the workers themselves or from people that work with them, you know, advocate counselors, et cetera, or people at needle exchange sites. It's a very typical way that we get one. And they call us or email us or write to us, and we have the description of the perpetrator and more or less what happened. And then we put it on the sheet, and that gets published every month. And then we put it out through those same agencies so that the people can then get it back. So it's basically spreading the word around about these people. Some of the places that you can pick them up are Outside In and the needle exchange sites that the county has set up. And then there are lots of drop-in centers for youth, you know, like New Avenues for Youth and Streetlight Youth Shelter. Rose Haven has it. And then we also mail it to Clackamas Women's Services is one, and then a few domestic violence shelters. We get them to those, and we actually even mail some up and down the I-5 corridor. We send some to Eugene, a couple of places in Eugene, like the Whitebird Clinic, and there's a place in San Francisco and in Seattle as well. One of the things about it is that there's a certain amount of liability involved with this, you know, so you kind of try and keep a low profile and make sure that it's kind of getting into the hands of the people that are actually going to use it rather than just having it publicly displayed out there.
So how did the Portland Bad Dateline get started?
Well, I was a Danzine volunteer. If you don't remember, Danzine was a nonprofit organization made by and for sex workers of all different kinds. They had a zine, and they had a needle exchange site, and they went through various things, had various programs and developed in ways. And so there was a group of us who got together one time when somebody came up to the needle exchange site that we had going and said that she'd been attacked. And then so we just faxed that description of what happened to all the different agencies. And then a little while after that, there was somebody who wasn't on the street but was an escort worker who got roughed up on the job. And so then we had a phone tree where we basically called everybody who we could get a hold of in the Portland area who was an escort. Because, you see, there are so many different ways to do sex work, and there tends to be different classes. That first call was in 1998. It was just a phone tree. This happened occasionally. And it was really for, you know, people who were lingerie models or escorts or things like that. And it didn't happen very often. But then it went through a few hands and nothing was really happening with it. And then I volunteered to kind of come in charge of it. And one of the things that I was coached on and realized really quickly is that it was, although I don't want to downplay the danger of the, what we call like the in-house work, you know, lingerie modeling, stripping, you know, escorting. I don't want to downplay the danger in that. But it became very, very apparent really quickly that what was really dangerous was work in the street. I mean, that's really dangerous. And the people who do it tend to be just that much more vulnerable. And the people who work on the street tend to be, you know, have very few resources with which to help themselves when they do get attacked. And so I started to really concentrate on that. And so that's when it developed into its current form of the monthly sheet. And now it goes out every month regardless as to whether or not we get a report. And I'd say we get a couple of reports on average. It tends to sort of cluster. It tends to be, you know, like 4 1 month and then 0 the next month kind of a thing, you know. We can't be real specific about who's doing what with it. All we have is just word of mouth. and what people say to us. And what people say to us is that they use it and that they look for it every month, that they are real enthusiastic about getting it, and that they keep it on them. And I've heard a few reports of people saying that it did prevent them from getting into a car that they thought they might have recognized from the report, you know, and that's really gratifying to hear. And the thing is that it's not just a safety issue. For me, it's an issue of empowerment that they can write it down, call it in, tell somebody, and have that person listen, have us read it, and then have it, you know, put out there again so they can look at it and say, you know, somebody, I did this thing. You know, maybe it'll help somebody else. And also, somebody listened to me, somebody cares. Somebody cares that it happened to me. So I think that's a really big part of the whole process. Listed on every publication every month at the bottom, it'll show three ways to make a report. It has a P.O. box, and then we have a voicemail box, and we have an email box. This is a very, it's an interesting operation because it's very small and very effective in a very just specific way. And it's fun. It's fun for that reason. It's nice to be able to feel like you're being effective in some way.
This preceding KBOO program has been made possible. The preceding KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing, featuring 100% natural fiber clothing for women and men, real clothing for real people. Proud to sponsor the important voice of KBOO, Gazelle is located at Northeast 41st and Fremont and can be reached at 503-288-3422.
Hi, Ralph Keyes here. In March of 1971, a new sound went out over the radio in Portland. The station was KBOO, and the sound was bluegrass music. Now we're inviting you to a party to help celebrate the 35th anniversary of Music from the True Vine, the longest-running bluegrass show on the West Coast. It's happening on Sunday, April 2nd, starting at 2 p.m. We're having music all day, a chili and cornbread feed, and we'll round out the evening with a swing dance. The KBOO Bluegrass DJs will share MC duties, so if you ever wanted to put a face to those familiar voices, this is your chance. Bands performing will include Jack Straw, Lee Highway, Greg Clark, Kid Mello and the Sleepy Eyed Johns, Little Joe, and the Flat Mountain Girls. A Northwest Fiddle Summit will feature some of the area's greatest fiddlers, and Portland's favorite Western band, The Buckles, will provide music for the evening swing dance. So come on out, 2 p.m. on Sunday, April 2nd at the Wonder Ballroom, 128 North Russell in Portland, for music, chili, dancing, and general celebration. I'll see you there.
Tickets are available at Pioneer Music, Artichoke Music, Wally's Music in Oregon City, at the KBOO office, the Wonder Ballroom box office, and all Ticketmaster outlets.
And this is the Thursday Morning Radio Zine for Thursday, March 16th. Coming up next, Press Watch, hosted by Teresa Mitchell, with the news you're not supposed to know.